point that you didn't until almost the end of the program, and here you found the U.S. flag over here hanging, but almost out of sight. It was sort of behind Netanyahu, but off camera. But when you did see it, how many of you noticed it did not have a fringe on it? Now, what the soup do you suppose that meant? Me too.
One other thing,
did they run out of fringe? What?
One other thing I'd like to add to this is I was in a rush to get this material. I had known about it and tried to track it for about 8 months.
Hold on a minute.
I've known about this procedure for about 8 months. I finally tracked it down, and I finally got a copy of the tape, which the tape is not a very good copy, but the audible is quite good. And he illustrates on the blackboard several things. The screen's a little small up there, but maybe you can make it out. But you're going to find something very fascinating happening here. And this gentleman has already filed in the Supreme Court, totally upset him, and there's backpedaling as fast as they can. You're not even hearing anything about it right now. So, but this will answer a lot of your problems. And believe me, you have more liability against those people now who have treated you this way, including the judge and the attorney, that you're going to be able to come back with major, major sums of fines against them. So I would suggest we get going with it, because it is long and tedious.
We disconnect.
Let's
hook it up.
Yes, let's.
Okay. We want to pause while we hook this up.
Okay. Give you a little background about myself. I started, went to John Marshall High School, and John Marshall High School was named after Supreme Court Justice John Marshall. And that was a very relevant part of my life when it came time to start studying law. I started that in 1980, but when I got out of high school, I went into the Air Force. And after I got out of the Air Force, I went to work at A. O. Smith in Milwaukee. And one of the first things that I learned about A. O. Smith was that you're never going to get rich with your back doing hard work. And it took about 6 weeks of working in a press shop at the age of 21, I believe I was at that time, and I enrolled at MATC night school, and then later, second semester, I enrolled in day school full-time on GI Bill and worked nights. Went to college 10 years, got industrial arts and teaching, taught college for 3 years, have an associate degree in metal welding technology and metallurgy. I went through divorce in 1980, 16 years ago, and a unique thing happened here. I hired an attorney, paid him $2,500, and wound up getting 1 weekend a month visitation of my children. When the argument was presented to the judge, it came down to, well, you have no constitutional rights. Because I asked him about my equal protection of the law. And that was my wake-up call. And I said, well, geez, you know, I don't remember my surrendering my Constitution to anybody or signing my rights away to anybody. So I went and I hit the books. And I started by taking John Marshall as a role model and reading what he had to write. The man has a very unique writing style. He said what he wanted to say, and he meant what he wanted to mean. And when I studied his material, I looked at the other Supreme Court justices and how they did their writing. And there were parallels in their style, but one thing was very defined is that he articulated on the definitions of his words. In other words, he took control of the words. Now, how many of you here believe 2 plus 2 equals 4? T-O plus T-O equals F-O-R. T-W-O plus T-O-O equals F-O-U-R. There's 26 ways to write 2 plus 2 equals 4. Did you hear what I said, what I meant, what I said, when I said what I meant, what I said? some of you have heard this before. What the point here is, don't believe what you hear and don't believe what's written in front of you. Because words have multiple definitions, words have multiple sounds, and the one thing that everyone must be absolutely defined when you're talking about law is the will of intent. Now, when you read in perjury, perjury says that you must prove the intent of a person's action in order for them to cause a violation. A violation is criminal. Criminal comes from the will of the mind. When you look up will in Black's Law Dictionary, you're going to get a couple pages of will as what happens when a person dies, how that is divided up. But the word will in itself is only one line reserved for criminal activity. It is a state of mind. And the second cross-reference for this is Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 9B, under fraud and condition of mind. The condition of mind is what the will is, the will of intent. So it is required that you look up not only a word, but the synonyms of words and how they interface with other words. In Black's Law Dictionary, you have several words that are incorporated, and they take one word and they join it to others in phrases. Now, you'll see it where it says in their will of intent. Or another one is allegiance. The word allegiance has a synonym of oath. There's also an allegiance of oath and oath of allegiance. So you need to look up the definition of each word and how they work together. They're usually joined with a preposition. Now, I'm going to go over a bunch of different scenarios today in English. In the last 20 seminars that I had taught, I had given people a fish because they were hungry. And then after they ate that, they wanted another fish. What I was doing is giving specific examples in law as far as the subject matter goes, and as each one was exhausted, they were still hungry. In other words, they weren't learning. They were only allowing me to think for them. So about 10 days ago, we did a seminar in Spokane. And what I did there was I initiated an English course because I found out people don't know how to read and write. As brilliant as everyone is, and as well as they write their law briefs and everything else, they don't know how to read and write. And this is where I had to first establish a foundation of communication. And from this foundation, everything I said after that was well taken and well understood. Now, when I studied from 1980 to 1990, subject matter, because this is the way our laws were written. It was conclusionary laws, and I felt that there was a philosophy. If copy a successful person, you'll be successful. So I looked up the 10 top lawyers in Milwaukee County. They're in the Milwaukee magazine. They had them listed. So I pulled their cases. Looked at their style of writing, looked at the way they drafted their law briefs. I was able to establish the style of how the format of documents were to be put together on any subject that you wanted to take. I also looked at the definitions of words that they were using and how they created their language. So I went ahead from 1980 to 1990 and had 63 hearings fighting for equal share of parenting of my children using this style. Now, every time I said yes, they said no. Every time I said no, they said yes. Which means we were at a standoff here. There's something wrong. We were dealing with a subject matter, not a procedure. So I had to go ahead and crack this formula. This leads to another story, and I'll tell you that because that will set the foundation for how I got into law and established the law. I'm not practicing law in any capacity. I've not broken any laws. I have merely taken and showed people how to write sentence structure and preposition, nouns, and verbs. I mean, it's as simple as that. I use the law as an example. We could talk about how to build a tractor, how to do welding technology. I'm well-versed in multiple subjects. I taught college for 3 years. I'm just an English teacher, folks. Just because I take the English words in that and I put them into meaningful definitions that we heard here today, doesn't mean I've broken any law. Otherwise, we're going to have to shut down every English teacher in the United States and get rid of all of our dictionaries and everything. So, when I went out to Montana, I spent a week in Cat Creek teaching the Freemen, there was eight of them, the procedure on how to read the law, how to understand the nouns, verbs, and prepositions. And from that, Leroy Schweitzer, Dan Peterson, and Mr. Clark constructed their Title 42 actions, and then also had the format for the other 24 defendants that were up at the farm. Now, while I was out there that first day, and that the United States, or the FBI, or somebody, whoever it was, moved two 155 howitzers, land-based howitzers, into a gravel pit 7 miles south of the Freeman camp. And this was witnessed by patriots up in the area. They cleared out an area 5 miles wide from where the howitzers were, so if they did use them, the flash and the concussion would not be heard. It would just be no more than distant thunder. 155 howitzer is about nine, throws a shell 9 inches by 28, puts a hole in the ground about 50 feet wide and 30 feet deep. And it goes 20 miles up in the air, and it comes down nice and quiet. And the whole farm blew up. Well, no witness, no crime. Fortunately, that never happened, because just last week, Charlie Duke got on television, and he made a statement that there was between 5 and 10 million patriots in the United States ready to go to war in the event the Freemen were killed. There was another factor. The land that the Freemen are on is under an old Indian treaty. That's why they couldn't trespass on that land. It was a foreign country. And that was a secret that was kept and never released to the public. The 80th day of the standoff, my Canton, Ohio tapes were taken into the Freeman, and they played the tapes for the Freeman. Leroy Schweitzer and Clark took the tapes in, and they showed them what the Title 42 looks like, and at which time they surrendered to it, because they identified with the remedy. You can't break the law to enforce the law. And the procedure outlined what they had to do on paper as well as verbally to be found innocent and to prove that that what had happened to them was a fraud. And when it went to court on July 16th, they did have a common law court, and Burns was the judge, and all the charges against the Freeman was dismissed. And they were promptly taken back to jail as political prisoners and held there, and they still are held there, because they won't sign a statement that says they will not talk about the bank fraud in the United States. Because of their highly exposed media, in other words, upon releasing them, you'd have every news network in the United States there, and they have the documentation to certify the bank fraud in the United States, that the banks are doing no more than taking our sweat equity of the future and loaning it to us at 9% interest. They're not creating money.
Creating credit.
Well, yes, they're creating credit, but they're doing it through contracts, which means it has not existed. It doesn't exist, therefore they haven't created it yet. It will always be in the future, not in the present. In other words, the almighty dollar that we have, this is being held in our hands. So this is present today. The government can create a present entity. But this is where the banks have the power to create something that hasn't happened yet. And they can't be tried guilty for creating something that has not happened yet. No more than we make the statement, the car went through the stop sign. Can't happen, right? Two objects can't occupy the same space at the same time. Therefore, this is a fraud. Therefore, case dismissed. So, how do you prosecute that? The car neglected to stop. Negligence, Title 42, U.S.C. 1986. Now you got a fact, but it's a negative. It's a negative fact, but it's a negative fact that's already happened. Therefore, you can't try it. If you make the assumption that the car will not stop, well, we can't try that until it actually takes place because now it's a presumption. Presumptions and assumptions are not legal. Therefore, if we create money based on future sweat equity by contract, the contract is binding only at that point in time that it takes place, as it takes place, which means it will always be in the future and not the present. Therefore, it can never be tried because it hasn't happened. And yet, if you don't do it, the second you don't do it, you become a negligent. You didn't stop. You're negligent. Now you breached the contract, now they can try you. See? That's where the trick comes in here. It's all in the words. It's all in the time. And what are the two rules? Highly defined, which they did with the contract, and all things are timely. Time is their avenue to the future, right. And time won't stand still. It moves. This is a secret that the United States government does not want the Joe public to know about, the bank fraud. Now you got it on tape.
Too bad for them. So the Freeman are still in jail, although the charges have been dropped?
Probably when this is, you know, spread around a little bit more. This is the first time I actually told that to anybody, about how time is relevant to the bank fraud. So you guys are all the first ones to know about that outside of the Freeman. But when you take these procedures and you expand upon them, this is where you get an understanding of what the power of this procedure does. Yes?
There was a trial up in Billings approximately 3 weeks ago. Two very good friends of mine attended. But the trial was for tax evasion.
Okay.
And that's what they're currently doing. Come on.
All right. I will address the tax issue for everybody. Now, okay, the paper money is a subject matter. It exists, it is now, the government can produce it. If you try and produce it without authorization, it's counterfeiting. Now, the banks cannot be charged with counterfeiting because it hasn't happened. It has never happened and never will happen. It's always in the future. They have a highly defined contract of what's going to happen in the future. But as all things are timely, it's just like if I'm holding a gun and I'm pointing it at you, as long as the gun doesn't go off, I'm not guilty of anything, correct? You haven't been injured. Upon dropping the hammer and the bullet actually touches you, then there's a violation. If I miss, the bullet misses you, there may be intent. The intent being that the bullet was supposed to go out of the gun when it happened, but there was no will, because if the will was there, you would have been hit by it. So maybe they might get you for making noise or scaring somebody. Why can't they be tried?
Because the Federal Reserve notes represent the future sweat equity.
No. The Federal Reserve notes are today's sweat equity. Okay. You work, you already did the work, and I'm going to give you money for it, okay? The contract with the bank is predicated, in other words, the credit they're going to loan you,
the note
that they're going to give you, is predicated on your sweat equity that you're going to earn in the future and then give it back to them. Now, as long as you make, every time you make your payment, you have met the word of the contract. Contract supersedes constitution.
And give them back the note.
Correct. You are staying current. So at the first of every month, you will pay $500 to this note. Okay, as long as you keep doing that, the sweat equity is being earned in the future, and you're paying them at a specific point in time by contract. So you've met your contract obligation. They haven't created anything, and you haven't, except you've given them back something because you promised to give it to them. haven't created anything. They have nothing. They've created nothing. They just created something that they just said that if you stay in this house, you've got to give me this much stuff because I own the house. I have the rodeo title to the house. Not a lodeo. Rodeo title. A lodeo title is what can't be bought, sold, traded, or given away. And you can't join anything to it. Because you can't join anything to an allodial title, they have to put a rodeo, R-E-D-E-O, title on top of the allodial. And then what they do is they mortgage that into the future. So the debt never exists. It's never tied to the allodial. And upon the point in time when the debt is due, this is when you are responsible by contract to pay it. If you don't, you pay a fine. If you go too far into the fine, they lose it and they take it away from you. But at no point in time have they ever created any money. They haven't. They're not guilty of counterfeiting. Yeah.
What's the essence of the bank's fraud in that transaction? The fact that they open an account and create a debt on their books. What's the essence of the bank's fraud?
There's no fraud on the banks. They're working with the future.
You mentioned bank fraud. What's the essence of the bank fraud that you're talking about?
The intent. What they are not doing is they are not giving you the will of the intent of the contract for what it is that they're giving you. In other words, when you get done paying off the contract 30 years later, you still own nothing. You don't owe them anything, but you can't get the allodial title to the property because they never owned it in the first place. They just had a rodeo title of statehood to manage the land, but the rodeo still is owned by the government. You haven't bought and sold anything. You're just paying rent. Everybody's a renter today.
In other words, they're creating nothing with nothing.
Correct. And it's all it is, you go out and you're buying your car with nothing. You're paying it back with nothing. If you had silver in your hand, that would actually be money to go ahead and do it. And I think silver is worth $39 and something an ounce. According to the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, the United States assesses silver at $39 an ounce, even though it only sells for $7 an ounce in coinage, and in bulk, $5 an ounce. So you go out and buy your silver coin, you present it to government, pay your tax with it, $39 an ounce.
I love it.
maybe the origin of the fraud wasn't just the banks doing. The problem was that the U.S. government and the banks got together under a supposition, an entirely 100% fraudulent supposition, that we the people owed any of the money that the government owed to the banks.
Okay.
And under that entirely fraudulent supposition, then the banks said, well, as long as we can keep that fact relatively undiscussed,
mm-hmm.
we'll go ahead and loan you, the government, money based on their future earnings, their profit.
Right, which is actually...
absolutely fraudulent.
Well, the will of the intent, if explained to you, would probably say, well, this isn't right, I'm not going to do it. But at the same time that they do it, it's all an assumption. It takes place in the future. It is not tangible at this point in time. Therefore, it hasn't happened yet. But they say, if you want to live here, and our guys with the guns and the clubs, if you want to keep them off your back, then you're going to go ahead at this point in time, give us our $500 a month, and you can live there and keep your family and put a roof over your head. That's what's going on. Yes?
What is the power that the premium do hold and the knowledge that they have?
I just told you. The power that they have and the knowledge that they have is that we are going to loan you your sweat equity. We are going to contract the sweat equity of your future. We're going to get a contract today. And you're going to pay me everything you make for the next 30 years. Yeah. Trouble is you do it by contract, so contract supersedes constitutional law.
Yeah.
You can't reverse in opposite. So I'm going to write you a sentence. All right. Sentence says the police officer arrested the defendant without a Fourth Amendment warrant. What's wrong with the sentence? Anybody want to comment on that?
Backwards, sir?
Well, you're close, but you're dealing with subject matter.
Yes, but the main clause of your sentence is the Fourth Amendment warrant.
Okay.
The subject is somehow
correct. Now, if we take this sentence here and we read it, the police officer arrested. Police officer is a noun. Arrested is your verb. Now, when you took English in school, you're always taught to write noun, verb, preposition. Right? So where did we create a subject? What we see is the way we talk. The police officer arrested the defendant without, what is without? Preposition. Without a Fourth Amendment warrant. All right? There's nothing wrong with this sentence. If you make this statement in court, the judge is going to say, this police officer has absolute immunity. What's his official capacity? He's supposed to arrest people. And because the injury took place after the subject matter, there's no injury. Because it's after the fact. And what happens? The judge is sitting up there, and what's your first word out of your mouth? The judge didn't give me my constitutional rights. Well, the judge isn't supposed to give you your constitutional rights. He is absolutely immune from everything he does. If he stood up there and took a gun and he pointed at you and shot you dead sitting at the table, and you said, well, he shot me and I'm dead. Well, too bad. He's absolutely immune from what he does under judicial immunity. Subject matter. Now, if we take this here and we stand in front of a mirror, what's going to happen? You're going to read, the police officer arrested the defendant without a Fourth Amendment warrant. Henceforth, the reflection of the mirror, the mechanic takes place, and the law lies inside the mirror. So now you're going to read it from left to right. And what are you going to get? Without a Fourth Amendment warrant, the police officer arrested the defendant. We started with a preposition. We started with a preposition injury. Now he committed a violation. Now we've stripped the police officer of all his defense. Without a Fourth Amendment warrant, the police officer has now committed a violation of due process of law under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. Now we've got three constitutional violations. While engaged in three constitutional violations, the police officer is now guilty of Title 18 U.S.C. 242. Deprivation of rights under color of law. But before you can establish any kind of violation of law, you must establish knowledge. Got to be smart enough to know what he's doing. Title 42, U.S.C. 1986 for knowledge of the law. Now that you've established his knowledge, what did he do? He didn't have a warrant, so now he's negligent. Title 42, U.S.C. 1986 for negligence. Then you can bring in your Title 18, 242, deprivation of rights under color of law. So you're saying, even though this is your statement is going to start. You can write this here, but then when you go into your injury, where you want to actually accuse the person, you use a broad-based statement without due process of law. Now, due process is a broad-based blanket. You can start any sentence on any injury without the due process of law and tie down a Fifth Amendment constitutional violation on anybody that's of oath and affirmation.
Except.
There is no except. It's under a you bring your preposition first. I've been telling everybody, I've been giving you the sentences, but what I didn't tell you was, you've got to do your preposition first, then your noun verb. We don't care what your subject matter is, just remember those three things. Preposition first, noun verb. Then you'll have absolute immunity or absolute power to nail anybody that's of oath and affirmation anytime, anywhere. And this formula will work in all 250 nations of the world, regardless what their constitution is. Everything is backwards. Everybody on this planet has been taught, regardless what your language is, what your politics is, everything, noun, verb, preposition. And the Supreme Court judges have been sitting up there knowing that the preposition comes first and it's been their top secret. The judges on the lower courts and the lawyers have never been taught this. They've been giving you fish every day. but they never taught you how to fish. Now, you guys can take your all your paperwork that you've done, all your Title 42s you've done, any case that you have ever looked at, and take that paragraph apart and start thinking about what it is you wrote down. Now, you can't use an adjective, you can't use an adverb, and you can't use a preposition. Pronoun. Now, an adjective describes the noun. It gives it color. Its prejudices, the subject. And I could say here, the black police officer, or the purple police officer, or the Chinese police officer. Or the bad police officer, right. What I'm doing here is I'm adding prejudice to the subject matter. And if I do that, I'm trying to influence the judge or the jury. That's obstruction of justice, Title 18, U.S.C. 1512. Now, if you're going to prejudice something, it's contaminated. And whatever your argument is, it's automatically disqualified. So anytime you put an adjective anywhere in your document, outside of the conclusion, it's automatic disqualification of your document. Your next thing is your adverb. Your adverb is going to tell what the color of the verb is going to be, how it's going to be influenced. You're going to tell at what degree the action should be applied. Again, you're creating a prejudice on movement. In all adverbs, anything ending in L-Y, scrap it. Take it out of your wording. Because you know what? Anything that you can put an L-Y in your sentence. And lawyers just love to use L-Y words. They just beat up the page with it. It goes ahead and it contaminates the document. I go through and I correct them. Anybody hands me a document, the judge gives me an order to dismiss something that I've done, and uses adjectives, adverbs, and pronouns, I go ahead and correct his paperwork and send it back to him. I says, go back to law school and learn how to write. And I said, this is conclusionary. This is presumptuous. This is an assumption as to what happened. Where is the law here? Your opinion is not law. And I won't accept your dismissal of my document. As a matter of fact, I'm going to indict you for treason against the Constitution and perjury of oath, because you swore to uphold the Constitution, and now you're trying to circumvent that. And what gives you the power to circumvent that? You went ahead and put that gold fringe flag up there. If you look at Title 4, USC 1, anything placed on the American flag is a desecration of the flag. And they reaffirmed that in 1994 under the Flag Burning Act about desecration of the flag.
During this pause, the camera is panning a courtroom. And
another unique thing happens here with placing a gold fringe flag in the courtroom. It creates a foreign entity, a foreign power. It takes the bar, the sanctuary of the bar, and it turns it into the deck of a ship. It's an admiralty flag, maritime flag, administrative flag, or equity flag. In any case, it doesn't represent any nation of the world. It also, because it doesn't represent any nation, doesn't have a constitution. They established it as an equity flag because an equity is done by contract. It is well established in law for over 100,000 years, since the caveman said, oh, I'll trade you my saber-toothed tiger for your brontosaurus right quarter there, that when two people deal in commerce, they create contract, and contract supersedes all constitutions. Contract is what creates treaty. Treaty supersedes all constitution because, in effect, it's a contract. What is our constitution of the United States? It's a contract. It's a contract between the people and our land, our allodial land. And it says it can't be destroyed, taken away, or changed in any capacity unless everybody votes on it. Three-quarters of the people got to vote on it, or the states have to vote on it to change something in the constitution. I've never seen any of that take place yet. So, in effect, our Constitution, written in 1776 and ratified September 17, 1779, is the supreme law of the land, and I haven't seen all 50 states agree on anything at any time. Well, I guess it's pretty well set in stone, it's still alive and well, and regardless what kind of fringe they put around our flag and say it's going to disappear, it hasn't. The only thing they've done is create a foreign power by putting the gold fringe around it. Now, what's the definition of treason? Treason says that if you take our Constitution and give it to a foreign power, you're guilty of treason. So, treason has always been giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Aid and comfort to the enemy, meaning in war. That was the intent. But there's a thing called constructive treason. Constructive treason is when you try and overthrow the government, overthrow the Constitution. Constitution is the government. So in effect, what we've done here is that the judge, being the fiduciary of the courtroom, is responsible for the colors of the court. Colors meaning the flag of the court. Comes under law of the flag. The law of the flag is respected in all nations as far back in history as I could find anything recorded. Even the caveman had a banner. One guy put up a bear, no one used a lion skin. They had banners to set down their jurisdiction and their territory. You look in Roman times, everything in the Bible, every picture you ever see about anything, you have got banners, you have got flags. Yeah, because people couldn't speak the same language, they couldn't shout far enough, but they could see the flags. They could see the banners. This was the territorial jurisdiction. And the ambassadors for whatever entity we have here would then go back and forth and establish whatever those rules and regulations are of that banner. And if that banner is up here, it says, if you don't wish to make contracts with my flag, don't come on my ship. Don't come into my country. Don't come under my jurisdiction. That's under the law of the flag, Black's Law Dictionary. So what our judges have done, well, not only our judges, started around 1800 with Rothschild. He took my procedure, the same procedure that was written in the Bible, the same procedure that is used in all the great religions of the world, the same procedure that is predicated for mathematics and sciences, because it deals with rules and regulations. It follows a time sequence. There's only two rules for a procedure. One is all things are timely, and things have to be highly defined. So that's what we've done here. This is untimely, and it's not defined. Therefore, it's irrelevant. Do you ever hear somebody say, the police officer gets up there and he says, well, he went through the stop sign. I had to give him a ticket. You know what the defense was? How does a 4,000-pound car go through a stop sign? Case dismissed. True story. Okay, I'll answer that question then. Remember, it's got to be highly defined. One, and two, all things are timely. If the police officer is doing an arrest, we have a subject verb. Doesn't that come before without in the sentence? And it's timely. We're establishing a subject before. We have a subject verb, a subject action here, before a subject violation. So, because it's timely, this man has immunity. What is a police officer supposed to do? He's supposed to arrest people. And he has absolute immunity when he's in his official capacity doing his job. Now, then you say, well, he didn't have a Fourth Amendment warrant after the fact. So what? It was your fault that you didn't bring it forward. You didn't make the statement first. Because you're saying that the arrest took place, and then after he got back to the station, the man's all locked up, then he discovered he didn't have a warrant. So that was an untimely statement. It's the way you say it, just like the car went through the stop sign. If you take things that are literal, because that stop sign is a solid object, and two things can't occupy the same place at the same time. Rules and fact of nature. The rules of nature. The same thing here. You can't, a police officer, in his actions of arresting, if he didn't have a Fourth Amendment warrant, he didn't have it before he went out there to cause the arrest, right? But if you don't establish that until after the fact, then he's immune from what he did. But if you put this into a mirror, you're always going to come out. When you read it, look at that sentence in the mirror. You're going to read it just like you do now. Left. You're going to read from left to right. And it's going to start with the preposition first and then the noun verb. And you'll always get the right answer when you look at something in the mirror.
So, I guess when you're saying that in order to defend against these kinds of actions that are being
violated, you must have a prepositional violation first.
Yeah,
you
have to. Okay. So that can establish what it was that was violated before you spread the action.
Correct, but you must do it in such a way that you have a constitutional injury take place first. Now, the constitutional injury that is absolutely guaranteed on everything is without due process of law. If you start every sentence without due process of law, you establish your constitutional violation before anything happens. Without due process of law, the judge brought into the courtroom a gold fringe flag.